So have you ever done an amount of training for an event or for something that's kind of that physical something that seemed out of reach at one point, but then you trained and trained and trained, and the day finally came, and you were absolutely ready. That may be, we're talking about track and field, that might be some sort of distance race or setting yourselves there. We participate in Face of America, which is a ride with veterans from DC to Gettysburg, and the first time you do that and you think about that trek, that journey, it seems like a pretty big challenge. Have you guys done that before or had those types of things? So imagine though that you had set out, you had a training regimen and you had a partner who was world class. And then kind of right off the bat, things start to change. That's what happened with Deborah Cyril right here. In 2001, she set out to with her husband to cross the Atlantic in a rowboat, because that's a thing normal people do, right? So this nautical, it's about 3,300 nautical miles if you're doing it right, to go from, do we have that next slide kind of gives you a perspective of where you're going, right? So kind of near Morocco down to Barbados. Like, what person even says, like the Google Maps that I brought this up at, the 3,300 miles, like it's a 20-hour plane ride, all right? So you know you're going far. And so what had happened though was that, so in kind of towards the end of the year in 2001, she and her husband were part of this race, and he was an international rowing, had these kind of international rowing accolades behind him. He's 6'5", built, he is the rower. She is 5'4", and really didn't have a rowing background, but I guess decided, well, if you're going to do it, I'll come with you, right? She had all the kind of pedigree, so they have this boat that is 24 feet long and set out for it. But one of the things that they realized about the third day in was that when you couldn't see land anymore, her husband started to freak out. Right? Yeah. You would have thought that she said that they did a lot of their training on the River Thames. And so that's very different than the open Atlantic. Okay. So about a weekend then, when you start hitting your first storm or so, she says that he really realized that he couldn't do it anymore. So this 6-week journey that was supposed to happen at like day 7, he goes, I just can't do it. And so they called a rescue boat. Rescue boat comes, picks him up. And she goes, you know what? I think I've got this. So think about that, right? That the rescue boat is there. It's not like you're still on shore and both of you are, no. Like you know what to expect now. And she said, I realized that when those first storm waves came, like he freaked out and I loved it. But there is a different kind of brain chemistry that happens then where you're going, okay, I've got about 3,000 miles left. No, I can do this single-handedly. And so they rigged up the boat so that it looked like, so it was just a one-person rower, so it wasn't off-kilter or anything. And it was good, though, that she had the amount of food for two people, because this 6-week-long trip turned into 111 days. What? She said that she slept maybe 20 minutes at a time, because she wouldn't know, and like the big, tankers that are coming across and those big ships, you're not gonna see at all, even on your radar, this little 24-foot plywood boat. How crazy is that, right? And so she tells this story, and all I can think is, what kind of faith would it have taken to say, as the rescue boat is there, as you could just walk on that, no shame in that game, because you've got, your Olympic rower, your international rower going, I can't do this, I'm tapping out. And you're all, 5-4 of you is going, no, I got this. Man, that's ridiculous, right? There is something in there. There is some kind of faith and trust that would have to happen that you would go, no, I understand what journey is ahead of me, but now I'm gonna let this water kind of sort out to where I might come through. And talk about some trying days, and to hear her story are pretty powerful. And so as we continue on with this second week of our Finding Your Christmas Spirit series, You know, we're exploring these ways in which this thing that we call the Christmas spirit has gifted us with a number of things that would allow us to do things that we never even thought possible. And so last week we talked about the gift of creativity and the way in which at the very beginning in our origin story in the garden, we see that there is this depth of creativity from our Creator who then makes us in God's image. And that we are called to create and that there's no shame in that. But then when sin and shame kind of creep in, it starts to calcify our creative muscles a little bit, and it starts to tighten everything up, and we start to pause and think about the ways in which we might not be good enough. And then God creates this way through Jesus to make a way that we can say, no, you were made to create. And we ended with our Miss Frizzle quote of take chances, get messy, and make mistakes. And so today, we come seeing this gift of faith that empowers us to step into that next God-sized dream in a way in which we never thought possible. And I think that one of the things that we talk about like a God-sized dream is to say, I could single-handedly go across the Atlantic. And I think that each and every one of us have at least one, if not a few, of those God-sized dreams that what we do is we pull back and say, no, there's an easier way. There's a rescue boat that's going to come. And God has called us. God has encouraged us. God has said, no, I got this. We can do it together. And so we kind of take a little bit and talk about this word faith, and it's kind of a tricky word, but the first verse in Hebrews 11 that Robert read for us, it says this: now faith is confidence in what we hope for and the assurance about what we do not see. Isn't that a pretty good definition of hope? That it's the confidence in what we hope for and it's the assurance of what we don't see. Because if you're like me, you're somebody who likes to see and be able to touch those things that we are placing our trust in. And if we can't do that oftentimes, especially for me, I'll try to take that on myself. So if something goes wrong, I know it's my fault and I know where it messed up. Anybody there with me, right? And so you kind of take ownership over that. But one of the ways that this word is translated in the Jewish scriptures that we have, each year I get a new Bible to kind of read through for that year. And so this coming year in 2019, I got a complete Jewish study Bible, and it so far has been really fantastic. But some of the translations, some of the names are more traditional to the Hebrew names and things like that. But the way that they translate this, instead of using the word faith, in bold, it just says trusting. Okay, so if we substitute some of that, it's the passage that Robert read for us. It says, by trusting, Abraham obeyed and being called out to go to a place where God would give him a possession. Indeed, he went out. And then it continues to use that, in trusting God, he received this child. In trusting, Abraham went and put this offering to the test where he offered up his son. In trusting, he was blessed by them being able to be that father of those that are like the stars. Isn't that kind of a neat way to reframe that word of faith? Instead of just this kind of blind ambition to look and see and believe just because the Bible says it, is this trusting in the way that God might work and move in our lives. And so one of the potent parts about this passage of scripture, though, is that it tells this larger story. And it helps me, at least, see this faith thing as not just a siloed individual thing, because sometimes we read ourselves too much into the scriptures, right? We say, this is all about me. And what this passage does is it kind of zooms out and goes, no. God has been faithful. God has been trustworthy from generation to generation to generation. You know, we see God as being faithful when Moses and the Israelites are kind of backed up against the wall and the Egyptians are coming. And through that water, there is a way made because God is faithful. God is trustworthy. That, they're in the wilderness and God is faithful. God is trustworthy because manna comes down and they have something to eat. God is trustworthy because there is victory, there is goodness, there is wholeness because of these ways that we then place our trust in God and God shows up. And so this passage shows us the way that from generation to generation, God has been faithful. And so as we take a look at that, as we see that this idea of then faith and trust, we have to also remember that faith is really committing to a faith of living and following Jesus and placing our trust in God, but not a plan, right? So the faith that we put as a disciple is committing to God, but not a plan, because sometimes those plans change, right? Sometimes those plans change so that when I talk with a high school senior or a junior who's trying to pick out a school and they're stressing out about picking that right one. And what if I don't pick the right one? And oftentimes, I'm the worst at having this conversation with young people at this point, because I go, then you just pick a different one, man. You just transfer and you go somewhere else, right? Because I don't think that our whole plan or everything that we are and have depends on us making sure that we go here instead of here. That if we go here, God can't work in my life anymore. No. Because we commit not to a plan, but to God. And so when we start to realize that when we make a commitment, we commit to God and not the plan, we go, oh, okay, so if both of these schools have what I need, then I can be fruitful in both places. If my job situation shifts and changes, God can continue to work. If my relationships start to fall apart, or my family structure starts to change, or if the grip of addiction starts to then deteriorate that plan that I had, but I continue to put my faith in God, that we have a God of second chances that rewrites that plan all the time, but we just continue to be faithful and trusting the God who is willing to walk through those dark places with us. And this is helpful for us to know, you know, in so many times. So the question then that I want to ask you, and you can respond, so think about it for a minute, is then what holds you back from fully trusting in God rather than the plan? What thing holds you back from going, yeah, I'm all in for what God has in store rather than the plan? What do you think? What is it for you? I think for me, one of the things is control, right? If I know where all the dots line up, then I can move that plan around to fit my need. What else? Overthinking, yeah? Like that plan has too many decisions, right? And so that analysis paralysis comes in. You're like, I don't even know the first place to step. Yeah, beautiful. Oh, insecurity and being stubborn. Those are kind of connected in some awesome ways, right? Right? That the things that we are secure about, then we hold on to those so we don't move. But those ways in which we know that we can't do things, or we have in our minds that we can't do things, and we don't step because maybe what happens if I fall? What happens if those things happen? Yeah. Any other thoughts? Being self-sufficient? Yeah. Those hurts from the past, or those things from the past, maybe have a way of coming back up and not wanting us then. We want to do it ourselves because I can do it myself. And then something goes wrong. You realize the weight of the world is on your shoulders. Yeah. Anything else before we move on? Perfection. Yeah. It's got to be just so, right? And if it's not up to my standards. Yeah, come on, Sarnia. Just make a list, right? Yeah. Brilliant. So as we continue, though, what happens is that when we start to place our trust in God, what we have to realize is that there are what I'm calling dark waters will come. That dark waters in those times of hardship, they're gonna come, that the things that aren't perfect, those stumbling blocks, those imperfections, those self-doubts are going to come up. But I can't help but think that, that when we look at Deborah's story about rowing, you know, what she said was that even in those 20 minutes where she was asleep, she could put down this kind of weird like sea anchor, which is just kind of a little parachute type of thing that you try to hold your place. But she would say that then if I woke up and I was disoriented, or the boat turned around, and there were some times where I was just too tired to even look at the stars, that she realizes that there were days or hours where she was rowing in the wrong direction. Or there were some days where those dark waters were just going at her so hard that it was all that she could do to stay in place. So she may have rowed for 10 miles, but on the map, she hadn't moved an inch, right? Wouldn't that would be it for, and you go, man, but she continued on. Those dark times, though, there are times and places where then when she talks about the way that she got to Barbados and she finished it, that how different a person she was for knowing that she had come through those dark waters and that she was a stronger person because of it. If we think about the way that God works and moves in our lives, and we think about those dark places or the darkness, and sometimes we talk about the way that we don't go into those places, but we avoid them at all costs, you know, that does a disservice to who God is. Because God is willing to go down into those dark waters. And we talk about the way that, you know, even the darkness is light to God. And so Barbara Brown Taylor writes this book called Learning to Walk in the Dark. And she says this. She says, when we can no longer see the path that we are on, when we can no longer read the maps that we have brought with us or sense anything in the darkness that might tell us where we are, then and only then are we vulnerable to God's protection. So all you perfectionists, all you, you know, that Joel, you don't have to worry about decisions that are being made because there are no decisions at that point, right? But when we start to break down those defenses, then we're willing to see God's protection. This remains true even when we cannot discern God's presence. And the only thing the dark night requires of us is to remain conscious. If we stay with the moment in which God seems the most absent, the night will do the rest. How cool is that, right? Sometimes even in those dark places, going through those dark waters, what happens is that to come out on the other side, sometimes it's just waiting and confidently hoping that God is going to show up in a powerful way. And that is maybe a greater act of faith than anything else we could ask of, is just to be present, just to know that God is showing up. Because when we know that we go into those baptismal waters, it may be dark and scary and different and things sound different and they look different and we try to open our eyes. But when we come up out of those waters, we are a new people. We have been delivered from the other side, like the people of the Red Sea. We have come and know that, yeah, there's gonna be hard times that are gonna come, but man, there's also blessing and gift of knowing that we have come and we have seen a God who is willing to go through those waters, not just and watch us, but go through those waters with us, dying to God's self as we die to ourselves, so that we might have faith in those things that we cannot see. And so in just a minute, we're gonna kind of set the baptismal font. And as we do that, this reminder of we are putting our faith and a commitment to God and not the plan. It's kind of like those marriage vows that we make, right? That we commit to that person, not knowing the plan that God will, or the plan that that marriage will take us. Because if we knew all the things, the reality is sometimes if we knew all the things at that point, we may not say yes to that, right? But those commitments that we make, we are making to that other. We are making before God and other people so that then we can come together and say, no matter the dark waters that go through, we know that there is going to be light at the end and that there is going to be gift. And so we give ourselves, we recommit ourselves every day to those commitments that God has in store for us. And so as we go and prepare the waters, the way that this is going to work is that today, Aaron Trawick is going to come up and we're going to reaffirm those baptismal vows that were made in 1993. And as we do that, we're also going to invite you guys to do some of the responsive reading with us. And then at the very end, during our last song, we're going to have some of our little ones or those who are young in spirit, or maybe those little ones that may need a spotter, okay, to come forward and take some of our evergreen branches that we have and dip them in those baptismal waters. And then they get to fling the water at you because that's one of the most liturgically fun things. That's like a church water balloon fight. As best we can get it, right? Is that then they're gonna sprinkle you, and as you feel those sprinkles, you're going to remember your baptism and be glad. So we're gonna shift a little.